I always enjoy bringing you the latest. This is The Scoop.
It's The Scoop with Darren Dookie Wolfson from 5 Eyewitness News.
And away we go on this Friday early afternoon, the 14th of May. The year is 2021. This is Scoop Podcast episode 350, going on 5 years strong. Older son Droogie needs to be at baseball for warm-ups by 5 o'clock. I've got some TV duties to attend to beforehand, so I will go quickly on some notes, but then really just get to the reason for this podcast. A bunch of cool conversations I had. I'm biased, but some cool conversations I had this week. Shameless plug, my Twitter, DWolfsonKSTP. DWolfsonKSTP had a couple scoops earlier today. Travis Blankenhorn to the LA Dodgers. Christian Darrisaw agreeing to terms with the Vikings, expected to put pen to paper later today. All right, let me begin with my conversation with Gerson Rosas, Wolves President of Operations. I caught up with Gerson on Wednesday afternoon. Gerson, always good to see you. Always appreciate your time. Always appreciate you doing these. Is it safe for me to think that, like, you're in this boat of you wish it was an 82-game regular season, that this year, this atypical year, this 72-game schedule, the way you guys are playing, that you would love to play another 10, 11, 12 games?
Dude, I really feel like if we had 25 or 30 more games, we could really make a run here and do some exciting things now that we're healthy and everybody's together. And as good as we're playing and still missing a guy like Beasley really excites you about the future. But no, you're absolutely right. We're valuing every day, enjoying every game, the competitiveness. It's great to be home and know that we've got 3 games against teams that are fighting for their playoff positioning, teams that are motivated to finish strong, that are going to give us an opportunity to see where we're at. What's good, what's bad, and what do we have left to address. So overall for us, these days and games are very, very important.
Maybe most impressive to me, Gerson, is, now don't get me wrong, you don't want to get down by 15 or more points, but I think the number is it six? You might know better than me, but I think it's 6 since about mid-March. 6 all under the leadership of Coach Finch, where you guys have gotten down by 15 or more and have fought back, have found a way to win those games. Like, to me, that's uber impressive.
No, I appreciate you saying that, Doogie, but it was, a major point of emphasis after the coaching change. We really felt like as a group, we really needed to raise our competitive approach. And it doesn't start by just winning games or coming behind. It starts by valuing every possession, offensively, defensively, giving guys confidence and belief that if we do the right things enough times, you can have success. I remember a big turning point was the first Houston game here at home where it was an up and down game. And our guys put together, I think, like a 22-0 run to finish the game. And that was done defensively. That was stops and that fed our offense. And that really sent the message to our guys that that's how we have to play. And you're right. You don't ever want to get into a situation where you're giving up big leads or you're falling by behind early. But a test of character is how do you respond to those situations. And the DNA that we're showing, the identity that we're showing of being a team that fights, competes. Even the other night against Miami, when we have D'Lo who's playing great and gets ejected from the game, and then we're in a situation where we have to fight. We were a 2-possession game, down 6-8 the whole way, and had a chance to get inside. A 1-possession situation late, but that's who we have to be, Doogie. And the reality is that's how you build winning habits. That's how you establish standards. And our guys know that. Right now we're earning the right to win. We want to get to a point where winning is something that we expect. And this is what this process is all about.
What do you think is tougher, making the climb out of the basement like you guys have, or now making that jump into – I mean, I don't know if the play-in tournament is here to stay next year, but let's say it's, a top 10 seed in the West next year or a top 8 seed, making then that leap into the top 8 or 10.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the leap up is going to be harder just because we're a lot better team than we've shown. And part of that is health. Part of that is the rhythm. Part of that is the chemistry of being together. But the opportunity to when our guys are together to show what we can do, and when it's Cat and D'Lo and Ant and what that record looks like versus when those guys aren't together. We haven't had an opportunity to experience it with Beasley as well and Jaden and his development. To be fair, this year with everything that happened, we haven't been able to start probably our best five-man lineup of, you know, D'Lo, Ant, Cat, Jaden, and Beasley. And, everybody was healthy early, but Jaden hadn't emerged at the level he had. And now where he's at. So we're still missing the opportunity to put that group together. But the continuity of what we did throughout the season, the opportunity for guys to grow and develop, and even the work that's going to take place this offseason going into next season. Like we say it here all the time, Doogie, but our next year has already started. This isn't about, oh, next preseason or next training camp or next season. It's now. We're building towards tomorrow every day here.
What do the next few months look like then? So you guys wrap up the regular season on Sunday, give guys a couple weeks off, but is the expectation guys are right back at Mayo Clinic Square here pretty darn quick?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Big summer for all our team. Big off season. It'll be a truncated off season just because we'll probably try to get back to the regular schedule next season. But in a lot of ways, it's going to be refreshing to have time to develop in the off season. It's going to be refreshing to have a summer league to look towards and really get our guys together and continue to build. But no, we'll give the guys a couple of weeks, get their bodies right, get their minds right, but then we're back at it. It's one of the silver linings when you don't make the playoffs is that you can turn around and get back to work here soon. But there's an urgency. Like, these guys don't want it to end. They're having a ton of fun. Everybody's playing well together. There's an expectancy to have success. They're enjoying the process of the work and the grind that it takes to be successful. And that's all you can ask for. You know, I'm a big believer there's no on and off switch. Oh, we're going to compete now or we're not going to compete now. It's who you are day in and day out. What you do is basically how you do anything. And our guys are hearing those messages. They're embracing those opportunities. And they're really coming together to challenge each other to be successful, which is what we need in this organization.
I mean, isn't the prime example of what you just said, Gerson, the New York Knicks in the East were, I mean, I look at their roster, it doesn't blow me away, but they could be as high as, what, a four seed in that conference. I mean, they play incredibly hard, right? I mean, that's a Tibbs mantra, but like everything you just said, I mean, like I think of the New York Knicks this year.
Yeah, no, Tom has done a great job of not only putting that group together, but putting them in a position to be successful and maximizing what their identity is. You know, our approaches are differently, but we're trying to do the same thing in terms of putting our guys in a position to be successful. We're trying to create situations offensively and defensively that we can consistently do to have success. And that's what good teams do. Be able to get stops or baskets on demand, whatever the case may be, and have the structure in place and the hierarchy in place and the players in position to do that. Good teams do that, the Knicks and teams in the West and in the East. But our fight, our competitiveness, our ability to work to our strengths, utilizing this young, athletic, dynamic roster, Chris and his staff have done a really good job of making sure that game in, game out, we're competing and leaving all out there on the floor.
You've brought up Malik Beasley a couple times, Gerson. I mean, any chance we see him one of these final three games?
We're hoping, and he's worked really hard to get back in. It's a hamstring, which is always very sensitive. I'd love to have him, even if it was just one game, just to get our guys together there. But we got to do right by him, and if the docs feel like there's any risk of re-injuring it, it's not worth taking the risk. We haven't fully decided on it because they're continuing to monitor him, and he's worked hard to get back. But at this point, it's probably more unlikely than likely as we work through it all.
How's Jarrett Culver doing after – when was the surgery, late last week?
Yeah, it was the 7th. He's doing well. A lot of early positive returns. And Jared's a trooper, and he deserves credit. He tried to work through it without the surgery. But the limitations with pain and flexibility and lateral mobility were really limiting him. And I give him a lot of credit. You know, he said, hey – this is a big off season for me. I don't want to waste any time. I don't want to lose any time. I got to get back to work and do everything I can to prepare myself for next season. And that's very commendable. You know, he's a talented kid that, as he continues to work and we continue to develop our team and our identity, we look forward to him finding his way and helping us and contributing in whatever way possible for us.
What kind of timeline are we looking at? Like, can he be back in the gym in a couple months?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think he'll be back on the floor here way before summer league. And I'd love to get him his first summer league games in his career since he hasn't played any. And it's going to be a pretty stacked summer league because nobody's played summer league for the last 2 years. So everybody will be playing summer league here this summer.
Okay, so Ant's going to play summer league?
Hey, you know, at some level, we'd love everybody to play. Everybody that's eligible to play, we'd love for them to play. But we'll see how it plays out. Ant's got a lot of minutes in the regular season. But at the same time, you know, there's a continuity. There's a team bonding. There's a team building. We might be able to get one or two games out of him here at summer league.
On Ant, Jim Pete, who to me is brilliant. Jim Pete forgets more about basketball in 2 seconds than I'll ever know. He was making the point on a recent telecast that he thinks Ant has tweaked his shot to some extent. Do you agree with that analysis? Like, how much has Ant worked on his shot?
No tweaks have been made. It's all about work. I think it's consistency. I think Jim Pete's got a great eye for it. I think what he's seeing is just the consistency of the same mechanics, shot in and shot out, which it's a credit to Ant and the work that he's doing and our coaches who are working with him. But we don't like to, tweak guys' shot during the year. I think what you're seeing and what he's seeing is the result of a lot of hard work where, to his credit, mechanics are becoming more consistent and he's becoming more consistent with his shot, which has been nice and fun to watch.
Do you care much about Rookie of the Year? I mean, and I'm not saying this because we're doing one of these on TV on Sunday night. My point was, if I had a vote, I would vote Ant because durability to me matters. That as great as Ball has been, he missed 20-something games. So I would vote Ant. Now, grand scheme of things, does it really matter? Like, Zion wasn't the Rookie of the Year last year. Who cares, right? Like, yeah. Zion, right? I mean, marvelous talent. But, like, you know, if you had a vote, I mean, with your bias, I get it, but you would vote Ant?
No, I mean, I would say this, and I appreciate the question. Do I care about the Rookie of the Year? To me, it's not the all-tell sign. Like, to me, if you look up and down the Rookie of the Years, you'd be shocked and surprised at some guys who won. To me, the biggest thing is who is the best player that's going to be out of this draft, and I have a lot of confidence in Ant, and over time, I think that story is going to be told. But selfishly, for him, for the organization, I think that's pretty special. And I agree with you. Like, the body of work, what he's done, what he's accomplished, when you look at the class and the durability that's involved, like, it's impressive, man. And I get so excited because he has no idea how good he's going to be. Like, he's just scratching the surface. You're talking about a 19-year-old, picked up the sport late. This is a second sport. Like, the reality of it is his physical talent, his just athleticism get you excited. But Doogie, he's learning the game. And Chris has done an unbelievable job of providing structure, accountability, and clear guidance of who we need him to be. And I think the best attribute that Ant has is that he allows himself to be coached. He allows himself to be a guy who is given direct feedback, and he responds to it. A lot of guys don't have that approach. A lot of guys aren't going to respond in that way. And that's what really excites me, because that's the key in him unlocking and maximizing his talent. But he's an extremely talented player. I think too often it gets lost what he's doing in terms of production, closing games out for us, his growth, his development with his attacking, with his finishing, with his drawing fouls, with shooting, his growth defensively. He still has a long way to go there. But what he's done with rebounding and playmaking and scoring, like, at the end of the day, if you looked at his body of work, it consistently adds up to Rookie of the Year winners. And, you know, I'd be happy for him in the organization, but I'm even more excited because I know what the future holds for him and how hard he's working and how committed we are to his success. And that all makes us, all of us, sleep better at night.
This might be moronic, but does he remind you at all of James Harden?
No, he does. James is a physical specimen. And having said that, when we got a chance to lay eyes on Anthony during the draft process, James is a Hall of Fame elite skill player. So it's hard to make the comp.
I know. That's why I might be moronic. I get it.
No.
He attacks.
Physically, Doogie, like, this guy is bigger, more athletic, stronger at 19 years of age. Javar Gillette, who's our director of sports science, who really set the table for James in Houston, is here with us now in Minnesota. And he talks about it all the time. Like, bodies are so, eerily similar, just structure, frame, lower body. But this guy has incredible pop and athleticism that James doesn't have. James has incredible skill and touch and feel, which Ant is developing. But anytime you can comp anybody to that level of player, it's exciting.
I mean, I'm thinking even when Ant is 21, 22, Gerst, that, like, there's still a lot of work he can do physically with his body, right? That maybe there's still, quote unquote, maybe some baby fat that he's going to, I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot more arm definition. Just he's going to be physically in a better spot 2 years from now compared to today.
Oh, absolutely. And I can't emphasize it enough, Doogie. Like, you take a player who he moved up in college. So he should have been a senior in high school last year. Like, physically, in terms of his development, his diet, his structure, that has so much upside and opportunity. You're right. Like, his body's going to change for all the right reasons. His ability to develop and prepare for a season, how he's going to feel. But you're absolutely right. To play the level that he's played consistently throughout the year, considering this crazy schedule and the realities that we're facing, it's impressive for a 19-year-old guy who hasn't experienced anything like this. And, I mean, he showed it last night. Like, right when you think he should be hitting the wall, like, the guy's boundless energy and charisma and feel, like, it feeds this organization, which is exciting to watch and be a part of.
I mean, one example you have internally, I think, of is Naz Reid. Like, to me, Naz has transformed his body. So, like, I see it there with your staff, and I guess that's a credit to Naz. Like, as brilliant as Ant has been, Gerst, like, I can make a case the best move you've made is Naz Reid.
And a lot of credit goes to our scouting staff, who was on top of Naz throughout his college career and was a big target for us. But it doesn't happen unless Naz wants it to happen. And his commitment to his body, to being a professional, and it's a shock that he wasn't drafted. It was a benefit for us. And when we had him in summer league and he played as well as he did, we were fortunate to get him under contract and make him a part of this organization for a long time as quick as we could. But our staff did an unbelievable job in evaluating, and our staff has done an incredible job in developing both the basketball side and the strength and conditioning side. He's truly revolutionized his body. And the exciting thing is, like, there's more growth and progress left. So at the end of the day, I don't think that guy's touched the ceiling yet. And with his skill, with his size, with his feel. And again, another guy that's been challenged. Coach comes in and says, hey, you might be playing the four. You might be playing the five. We want you to roll more. We want you to shoot better. We want you to defend better. We want you to rebound better. And he's taking the challenges. And we're establishing our environment and our culture and our organization as a development program. And, there's guys that have had success, and we have to maintain that, whether it's Naz or Ann or Jaden or Jalen or Bando. Those guys have come along and have given us a chance to play how we're playing right now.
Where do you stand on Cat guarding fours? I'm not saying, like, for the entire game, but, if there's an opportunity to bring in, a Miles Turner, a Holmes from Sacramento, somebody of that ilk, like, where do you stand on just the idea of Cat guarding power forwards?
We're very open-minded. I think if you study the data, his switch numbers are actually pretty good. His ability to move on the perimeter to contest shots, good offensive players are going to make you pay for that mismatch, and they're going to attack you and get you into foul trouble or get you at the rim. But his ability to stay in front of guys to challenge shots and contest gives us a fighting chance. So we're exploring everything. We've got to address the big spot in any way. The Naz, Cat, lineup has helped our defense, has helped our rebounding. So those are things that we're studying closely. But I do feel like, to your point and to your question, Cat's ability to switch, to spend some time on some fours, gives us some flexibility to make different decisions than we've made in the past.
Speaking of flexibility, remind us just what sort of flexibility you have in terms of this summer. Like, even draft pick wise, we know the first round pick up in the air. Second round pick, I can't recall. Do you have one? Do you not have one? Do you have the mid-level you can use?
Yeah. No, so depending on how the lottery goes, we'll see where we're at draft wise. We've set up a pretty good structure to leverage each side of it. So if we get the draft pick, that's probably going to be our big addition. And depending on what we do there, whether we select or we pick, which will be very thorough and aggressive to look at, we'd be adding another layer of talent there. But other than that, I think we'd be operating in more of a trade focus to improve the team. If we don't get the draft pick, then we've already put ourselves in a position where we'll have some financial flexibility with the mid-level to address some needs, which will add talent to the roster as well. We drafted Leandro Balmaro last season. Part of the thinking was that, if we were to lose the pick, we'll have another young player coming that we're very excited about. Potentially this year, depending on how everything plays out. And then we'll continue to look at every avenue and every opportunity through the trade market to see what we can do to upgrade our talent level and address needs on the roster. But we've prepared accordingly for either route, depending on what happens lottery night. But I'm excited about where the team is. I'm excited about the work that we're doing. And to continue to add, talent or young players or to address needs are the next key steps in us continuing to be successful and to build a winning program.
On Leandro, like, do you want to bring him? And it's more a matter of him being able to work out a buyout with his team overseas and him probably having to contribute some money to that buyout. Like, can you sit here and say definitively you 100% want him here next season?
We've mapped things out with him and his representation. We're in a very comfortable place. To bring him or not to bring him next year. A lot of it is his opportunity to play and develop, which is important for us and for him. And that's what we're working through. But we're very comfortable at the options of bringing him in. He's had a great year in Barcelona at a super high level. They're currently in the Final Four there and competing, which are special experiences for him. But he gives us another layer of talent. He gives us a lot of flexibility and versatility, which we're really excited about.
On D'Lo, so I did one of these with Chris shortly after he took over, and he mentioned Gerson, that he wants to unearth more of D'Lo's playmaking. I think we've seen a good amount of that. Now, maybe it's recency bias, the game last night in Detroit, but like in that pass to Jordan McLaughlin was phenomenal. But I think we are starting to see some more playmaking there.
It is, and a lot of it is, Doogie, is the ability of putting the right lineups out on the floor. And our spacing is good right now. Our pace is good right now. Guys are in the right spots. We're putting a lot of pressure on the defense. And people don't realize the balance that D'Angelo has with not only his scoring but his playmaking. And his IQ is so high, it's by design. Like, right when you think the guy is just scoring, he reads the defense and he'll make the right play. And a lot of times he can make plays or make passes a lot of other guys can't. But it's impressive. Sometimes you got to live with some of those turnovers because there's some risk involved. But his vision, his creativity with the ball, with passing, just shows you how effective of a playmaker he is. And we've needed that in this offense. And we really, really struggled last year without that factor. But when you got a guy that can pull up from anywhere on the floor, and when defenses make mistakes, he can make them pay, that's incredibly valuable and important next to a guy like Cat and now next to a guy like Anthony. I mean, I don't think it was by coincidence that Ant had the game he had the other night when D'Lo's first start. I mean, his career high in points and, big credit to those guys and the chemistry that they're building together. But it just the layer that D'Angelo brings with his shooting and his playmaking makes it tough for defenses to guard him, guard Cat, and guard Ant, which really excites us.
I know your phone's dinging. I'll hit you with two more. So
no worries.
They implemented the new lottery rules, 2 years ago? So We've seen, I guess it would have been the 19 lottery, the 20 lottery, so it's now the top four, right? You can correct me if I'm off base on this. It's top of my head, but I'm pretty sure that of the eight teams, those four and then the four, so adding those two together, the eight, five of the eight jumped up pretty significantly, like from sixth, I don't know how you would look at it, you know, sixth worst record or below. Like, there was significant jump up. So, like, you've mentioned this with me before, like, you don't want to mess with the basketball gods. So, like, hey, you guys may get some positive mojo, maybe move up in the lottery for the first time in franchise history just based on the last 2 years. Or, Gerson, I'm cool with if you end up giving pick eight or pick nine to Golden State, sign me up for that in this draft. It's okay.
Now, at the end of the day, it is true, Doogie. You and I have spoke about this extensively. The most intelligent and sensitive individuals in this organization are our players. They see everything. They know everything. And they realize everything. And the moment you go from, hey, we're not playing to win or compete, to we're playing for a draft pick, their motivation and their commitment and their credibility in the organization is shot. And for us, when you talk about the need to be a competitor, the need to build a winning program, the need to come in day in and day out and do the things that we need to do, we can't compromise that. And that's what we did last year. You know, we struggled. We had injuries. We had a hard year. But at no point was there a discussion or a thought of, hey, we're tanking or we're trying to lose. And you get what you deserve in this game. Same thing this year. And history will tell you. Most often than not, the team with the best odds doesn't win the number one pick. And that's just history. And the reality is, if you look at the odds and you look at the numbers, as high as 40% in one of those early slots, you still have a greater chance of coming out. And it happens, and it happens consistently. You look at New Orleans with Zion and what happened there. So if we can build a winning foundation, you still have the upside regardless of where you're at in the lottery to jump up, and we'll see where that falls. I mean, there's a reason why we protected the pick up to three. At some point, we have to give it up. It's the cost of doing business, but we're confident in what we're doing. We're confident that good things are coming because we're doing the right things for the right reasons. And we can all live with that. We're excited about the group that we have. We're excited about the continuity and the development of moving this group forward into the future. And when you worry about the things you can worry about and don't try to manipulate or control things you can't worry about, you know, good things happen. And we're looking forward to that.
On the top three protection, was that one of those just negotiating sticking points where they tried to get zero protection, you went back at them and said, no, I need some protection. Oh, and you guys met at three instead of, you know, I'm sure in your ideal world, it would have been lottery protection or top 10 protection, but you got to give to get.
That's typically how it works. And finally get to a number that both sides are comfortable with and both sides are willing to move forward.
Will you go out of your way? My last talking point for you. Will you go out of your way? I don't know if it works timing wise, but 4:30 on Saturday, whether on your, cell phone, the TV, will you be glued to the, ESPN telecast of the Hall of Fame enshrinement? I mean, Duncan, Kobe, KG, about as good as it gets.
No, I will actually be there, Doogie. I will be there. And a lot of special individuals, including Garnett, Rudy Tomjanovich, who's a consultant for us and who gave me my first job in the NBA, will be enshrined as well. So a special day to be there, and I'm excited specifically for those two individuals.
Fantastic. So that's great. So was it Rudy who extended the invitation or just your relationship with Rudy, or how did that come about? Because I have to imagine, I don't know what the setup is at the Mohegan Sun, but like, I can't imagine it's going to be like this huge, right, gathering, right, just with everything COVID wise.
I think it is going to be a huge gathering. I mean, I think it's pretty much a league event.
Okay. You
know, all the teams represent, but it will be something special. I mean, unfortunately, with what happened last year and not having the class then, I think it's very meaningful to everybody to be there and to support, you know, not only from, you know, basketball, but the league as a whole. It's a very special class and very fortunate to be a part of it. I've had a chance to be there a couple of other times for Tracy McGrady and Yao Ming, and it's something that I don't take for granted. It's you know, it's a legendary place that's very special. And when legends like Kevin Garnett or Rudy Tomjanovich are involved, those are rare occasions you don't ever want to miss.
How involved is Rudy on the day-to-day operations with you guys?
He's a personnel consultant for us. He does a ton of scouting for us. He's involved in draft and pro personnel. He was with us last year during the draft when we initially brought him in. And he's a guy that has incredible perspective. I mean, he was an all-star and on a Hall of Fame career on the court. And then off the court, the guy's done every job in the NBA. He's scouted. He's coached. He's coached internationally, an Olympic gold medal winning coach. A ton of knowledge, man. A ton of perspective for us. And a very talented individual that we're very blessed to have as part of this organization.
Gerson, thank you. Safe travels out to Connecticut. I probably stole too much of your time, so thank you.
Always a pleasure, Doogie. Thanks for catching up.
Wolves President of Operations, Gerson Rosas. Let's continue the Hall of Fame dialogue. One of Kevin Garnett's best friends to this day is Twin Cities resident, former teammate of KG's, Gary Trent Sr. Gary Trent Sr. and KG were on that 03-04 team that lost to the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals. Gary was nice enough to come into studio earlier this week. Wide-ranging conversation. It went for a while. Here's a snippet of that conversation. Gary Trent Sr. on Kevin Garnett.
So, Gary, you come here as a free agent. It would have been October of 01, that summer, but you start with the Wolves, the 01-02 season. So KG had been in the league for multiple years, but he hadn't done anything in the playoffs, right? Like, he was a good player, maybe even a great player, but maybe he wasn't, like, quite a Hall of Fame player when you joined the Wolves. But how soon did you realize, after playing with KG, heck, was it the first practice, the first regular season game? When did you realize, hey, I'm playing with an all-timer, like I'm playing with one of the 20 to 30 to 40 best players of all time?
You know, his MVP season, I saw just some things that I had never seen. A player get in certain zones, have those hot moments in the games where you don't miss. And the thing that I remember the most about him and I love the most was just his preparation. You know, when you came to the game, like, you already knew, like, when you enter the locker room, don't come in here on your phone. Don't come in here playing. Don't come in here joking, Kev. They got the game on, the scout game on. You know, whatever team we playing, we're watching their last game on TV. Don't be in here on your phone talking about all that with the tickets and all that. Do all that in the hallway or something. And that was the air in the locker room. And, you know, as a coach and as a player, you know, I like that because it's a tense, but it's also a focus. You know, you got guys goofing off too much, joking and playing around, and this is game day. You had all season, and you had 5 hours today to get the tickets and all that put together. So the preparation and his intensity of what he wanted to be is why he is that.
Was it harder to be his teammate or to play against him?
No, it wasn't hard to be his teammate at all, especially if he was going to work hard, you know. To be his teammate, all you had to do was compete hard. Go out here to win, sacrifice, give it your all. And if that's in you as a competitor to somebody in football, basketball, baseball, everybody wants that on their team. So it was never hard to be on the team.
All right, let's revisit the MVP season. I still think to this day, if Sam doesn't get hurt, like, I think you guys could have won the championship.
I don't think I know so. You can't get to the last stage of war and lose one of your generals. You know, not saying that it still couldn't have been done, but those type of things, you know, they hurt your army at war. And we're at war at that point in time, and, you know, you lose that leadership, you lose that insight, that understanding. You know, Sam might get a call that might not really be a foul or iffy call, you know, questionable call. He might get that call where they might not give that to Troy Hudson because he's a younger guy and you're not as, you know, Sam won championships with Houston. So, you know, there's certain things. He might get three fouls in that game. Sam could draw three fouls that change it where Troy might get the one, but the other two, they're not going to give him. So just all those little just intangibles like that. Because if you look at game 7 against Sacramento, which was on TV last night, you win it by that three-pointer that Weber missed at the buzzer. So those games can be determined by those things where Sam got that free throw foul that Troy couldn't get or Spree could get, you know?
So I'm thinking back to when he was drafted, you know, mid-90s into the late 90s. Like, right now, stretch four, right? Like, we even have stretch fives now. But, like, back then, in the late 90s, like, we didn't know what the heck a stretch four was. Like, in so many ways, and it wasn't just KG, right? Dirk, even a guy like Antonio McDyess. There's other guys. But KG and Tim Duncan, for that matter, too, to some extent. But just the way KG transformed the way that position is now played, like, that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Well, first off, the stretch terminology is getting stretched a little bit too far. A lot of them guys are soft. Well, they soft. That's all that is. They soft. When I watch you at 6'10", 7 foot, attempt more threes than anything in the paint, you soft to me. I don't care what you feel. But KG, Dirk, and those guys, you know, even when you look at Bob McAdoo and them, a lot of those guys had mid-range jumpers to evolve their game. And that's what Kevin wasn't known to be just knocking down threes. Now, Dirk was that, but Dirk came in like that. Dirk came from Europe where those big guys shoot threes just like a Sabonis. But a lot of these guys today, they're shooting the three because that's what they're being told from analytics and the game and all that. But also, it helps you be soft because you don't have to get down there and bang like you want. So, you know, they're masking it. And you're not allowed to bump and grind the same. But Kev, I believe, you know, a lot of people say Tim Duncan, right? And, you know, the Spurs organization is so intact of how they run things, you know, that I believe with that level of management and that level of structure, Kev could have done those same things in that position when you get a team and you build and run a dynasty. You know, the closest thing he had to a dynasty was Sam, but he was older. Spree, he was older. You didn't get no young guys that could grow with him and run with him, you know? So I think that you know, kind of kept him out of some of that conversation. But here's my thing that I always look at. You know, I coach sports, so parents come to me and be like, my son plays guard or my son plays this. No. In the sport of basketball, your position is determined by you are what you can guard. Don't come in here and tell me your point guard, you can't stand in front of one. No. You are what you can guard. So, on a nightly basis, I never will watch Popovich come out and say, hey, Tim, start out on Kobe. Hey, Tim, start out on Peja. Hey, Tim, start out on Tracy McGrady. I've seen Flip do that with Kev. Kev, start out on Peja, and then at halftime, Weber might be doing something. Hey, guard Weber the second half. You're not going to be able to do that. There's no other power forward you can do. You couldn't do that with Dirk. You couldn't do that with Duncan. You couldn't do that with them guys. You couldn't tell them, bring the ball down and run our offense. Start, initiate our offense. No, you can't do that. You saw that videotape that's on YouTube, Kev, at the USA team, giving everybody work. Tim ain't going to bring the ball down, cross you, give you no work, pull up on you like that. So from a skill standpoint and an athletic standpoint and an impact my team standpoint, I'm taking Kev because I can get more out of him. I can get him to do more. My point guard getting let Tony Parker get in foul trouble against Kobe. Popovich can't say, hey, Tim, switch on to that. No, Flip can do that. Hey, Sam in foul trouble or Spree in foul trouble on Kobe. I need you to take him, Kev. And I've seen it. I'm talking about this ain't a switch on a pick and roll. This is at the beginning of jump ball, you take McGrady from jump ball. So there's been time. I done switched out on Allen Iverson, you know, but that's a switch moment. When the coach assigned you to that, he believed you can do that. There was no other power forwards doing that.
I mean, the ultimate two-way player, right? That you're right. Like, I would feel okay him guarding Gary Payton or John Stockton if need be. Like, literally could guard 1 through 5.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't be lost if KG had to guard a 1 or guard a 5 and then everything he could do on the offensive end. Like, the ultimate two-way player.
Yes, I truly believe that. And I believe that because I watched it. When I sit here and watch a coach take a 7-footer until he start out on Kobe and he actually be effective, you know, it's not like Kobe just came out and killed him. Kobe gave work to anybody. But the fact that you start him out on a McGrady, it's you're not doing that with other guys in the league at that point in time. And still to this day, you wouldn't, you know, you don't put certain people out there. And that was just his athletic ability and his blessing of being that.
I think about his story starting in Malden, South Carolina, then transitioning to Farragut Academy in Chicago, being that high draft pick. Like, there was a lot stacked against him, right? I mean, we saw a lot of guys make the jump from high school to the pros, and it failed miserably, right? Or failed. Darius Miles. I can go up and down a list of guys. Why do you think it worked so well for KG?
Because he worked his ass off. Darius Miles wasn't in the gym. Look at Kevin's game when he came in to when he left. Look at the skill. Look at how it improved. Look at how the moves improved. He believed in Kevin McHale, and he listened to McHale. All them up and unders, all them pump fakes and all this. What Kev saw was, McHale saw was, let me download this guy with all my stuff on the athletic frame. Because McHale wasn't that athletic, but he was crafty and smart. So to take all his craftiness and his ingenuity and his experience and download it in a more athletic version, so what more could you want? So, you know, all the moves and stuff. So him, it was him being the GM at the time and being here was a big blessing to Kevin's game. Not saying Kevin wasn't going to be great, but when you have greatness teaching you, it increases your chances to be greater. And I think that was a big piece of that. But it was all on Kev to still work. It was all on him to still put them hours in, you know, and he did that. And that's why a lot of those guys from high school didn't work, because they got to the league so young. They thought, I'm here now. I've made it. Once you get here, it's like a starting over. You're at the bottom of the totem pole. You got to start over again, you know. And he just kept climbing and climbing.
Nationally, and I get it because he won a title in Boston. I think nationally, most people, when they think of KG, they don't first think Minnesota. They think Boston. And I'm telling you, I get it, because he won a title there. But, like, how would you classify that? I mean, would you use the word unfortunate?
People think Boston because the market was better and bigger at that time, as far as they were on TV all the time. They were the big three. They was on the covers of things. And they actually won, you know, because when Sam and Spree came here, they was on the cover, SI with the big three and this and that. But you didn't win here. We weren't on TV the same. You know, Boston has a lot of tradition. Minnesota has none. So I think that's why people identify with him as a Celtic, because when you watch TV and they run Bill Russell and Burr and all that, they put him on there. They're not doing that in Minnesota. They don't run him with the tradition. They run new guys and throwback moments, but, you know, you're not running KG moments. But I think that was due to the level of betrayal he felt here. So when you feel betrayed and people do betray you and do certain actions, I think that's where the disconnect came in. And that's why, instead of a Timberwolf, it's a Celtics.
How many conversations have you had with KG over the years about, now you weren't here, but after you guys lose in the Western Conference Finals, those next couple years before the trade to Boston, like, those were not great teams. The front office didn't do a good job of assembling the talent around KG. Like, I think a lot of us thought, sure, it would have been nice if KG could have spent even more time here. And I'm not even convinced to this day, Gary, that KG really wanted to get the heck out of here.
He never wanted to leave. He had plenty of chances to leave, to force a trade, to go play with Kobe before Shaq and things of that nature. He had all those. What he was destined to do was bring Minnesota a championship. He wanted to have his own championship. Kind of the way Lillard talks today about not leaving Portland. That's where Kevin's heart and spirit was at. Like, no, I'm going to bring a Minnesota championship here. Guys are going to want to come here and play with me the same way LeBron can get guys to come and want to play. And it just never happened. You know, a lot of it was management decisions. All of it was management decisions, but also, you know, the unfortunate situation with Joe. All those draft picks you lost over years, that lost talent, but it also lost your leverage to be in the negotiating game. When you're talking to trade with other teams, you got to trade me with a straight-up player, because you can't give me nothing for my future. You don't have anything coming for your future. And also, when they come to the table, when you in that business and you have really no leverage, what you coming in here with? You're not trading Kevin, so what you got? You ain't got no draft picks, so you got to give us Kevin, or, like, you know. So, you know, 5 years of that, it's hard to recover from. That's a hard blow to recover from, especially if the people in the office are not constantly using ingenuity on how to make things happen.
Well, on that, piggybacking off that, like, how do we even describe the relationship? It's not even a relationship. KG and Glenn Taylor, right? That, like, they haven't even talked forever. Like, we all believe, we all know KG's 21 should be up in the rafters at Target Center. The fact that it isn't.
Well, here's the thing, though. The foundation of Kevin's heart and the foundation of his mindset and spirit as far as basketball was to never be outworked. Nobody's going to outwork. Nobody's going to grind harder. Nobody's going to be more passionate. Nobody's going to put more into it than me. So that means everything. So for Glenn to come out and say those things he said before he traded about being lazy and isn't this like, you know how in the mob world, like, to say some guy's a rat and he's not, that gets you killed. Like, what? He said he was like, so it's almost that level of disrespect as far as that's what I stand for. Like, that's almost like calling a great father a deadbeat or something. You don't tarnish his name like that. And then it looks even more faulty and petty on his behalf because you said all those things about him and now you trade back for him. And then you pay the trade kicker money and all that to get him back. Now, you telling me you went back and got this lazy, bad leader and all that? So when you say things like that, you know, those things, yeah, you move on. But when you smear somebody's name like that, man, that's hard to let go when my name represents that.
And then you think about, okay, so he's traded back here. He goes to Brooklyn. Boston trades him to Brooklyn. Brooklyn trades him here. He waives the no trade. Flip had everything to do with that. Mm-hmm. You know, but what was promised to KG by Flip? What did Glenn know? I mean, there had to be some sort of plan, right, that if Flip doesn't die, KG becomes involved post-playing career. And I don't know if that would have involved, you know, buying a sliver of the team and becoming a limited partner, a part owner. He was going to be involved, though, right, in some form or fashion?
The plan was when Flip came back here, you know, Flip, you know, loved KG like his son, you know, and their relationship, you know. So Kev came back with a mindset, I'm going to finish up with Timberwolf, and, you know, I'm going to have a certain position here, you know, some ownership, but also influence. You know, you don't cut on TV and when it's free agency time, you hear people saying, oh, I'm trying to go to the Timberwolves. People will sign here for the money, but you don't hear people requesting that I want to go play Minnesota. You don't hear that. You know, you hear people say, oh, I want to go to Heat. I want to go to Lakers and play in Miami, LA. You hear that. So with Minnesota not being an appealing place to live and play to a lot of athletes, you know, you got $50 million. You want to live in Minnesota in the snow or do you want to live in Miami? You know, it's just nature. So especially if you come from cold, like, you know, you want a change of life. And I think, you know, he was going to have a great influence on being able to bring people here. And I think another major mistake, they made a lot of mistakes during his career. But then the mistake they made at the end of his career was you bring a guy in here to carry the torch of the franchise in Carl, and you don't keep Kev here, at least for the first 3 to 5 years of his career, just to show him how to walk that walk. This is how you be a franchise player, you know, more than the on the court stuff. Like, you know, and Carl did a great job as a rookie and just coming in and being into this world. I was very impressed by his work ethic and his mindset as a youngster, you know. But still, 20 is 20. You know, when Kevin 40, 41 years old, you know, Carl was as young as our kids, you know, could have been my kid. So when you look at that, there's no way that Kevin shouldn't have been here for at least his first 3 to 5 years, even if they could have kept him on the bench like Haslam, like in Miami, or if not, some type of in the office, even if you come back here a couple days, a month to work with him, there is no way that he shouldn't be involved here. But,
well, do you think that even impacts Carl to this day? You know Carl incredibly well. Carl is a rock solid player, right? But Gary, he's not an all NBA player, right? There are centers above him. Rudy Gobert is above him. We can debate that, but Rudy Gobert is above him. Well, Joel Embiid is above him. Nikola Jokic is above him.
I say the reason why I say yes is not because of what Carl hasn't become, because of what I know KG could have gave him. You know, this is not a knock on Carl. I just know Carl got this far, got to where he's at by being what he is and being this and that. But there's no way that a man who has accomplished so much at your position, there's no way that KG couldn't enhance him. There's no way. So, you know, I know he would have been better. I know he would have been better just from the teachings, from doing a film session with Kev, because whatever Carl became in his third or fourth year, maybe he could have been that in his second year. or whatever he was doing in his fifth year, it could have been in his third year with having Kevin there. So Carl was still going to become that, but you could have been that sooner and more dominant and better off polished mentally just because having that greatness in front of you. But, I mean, that's why there's been no championships here, and that's why there's been a lot of blunders just because of the things that's going on, you know? I mean, you look at Thibodeau now. You win somewhere else, and you win it now again. You know, I mean, people talk about his style all you want. He won in Chicago. I mean, you know, till everybody started getting injured. You took the Minnesota from the longest drought ever, got them back in the playoffs, got them winning. Now you're in New York, you're getting them out of a drought. Hey, that's not magic. That's work. That's research. That's film time. That's being dedicated. So, you know, just look at that situation. There's just been a lot of missteps along the way is why things are where they are.
Due to time constraints, we will transition to my next conversation, but I went with Gary for about another 15 to 20 minutes. We talked about his son, Gary Trent Jr., now with the Toronto Raptors. We talked about more on KG. Gary Trent Sr. is rock solid. I will welcome him back to this podcast anytime he wants to come back into studio. Let's continue the KG dialogue with somebody else who to this day is still incredibly close with him. Troy Hudson. So like Gary Trent Sr., Troy Hudson was on that 03-04 Wolves team that went to the Western Conference Finals. Troy and KG, many memories together. I'm telling you, they are really, really close to this day. I caught up with Troy via Zoom the other day. Troy, I appreciate your time. So you signed here. So you were in Orlando. I think you were here in the late 90s, maybe training camp, but you're in Orlando. You end up signing here as a free agent before what, the 02-03 season. I'm sure you knew about KG, but like how soon did you realize after playing with him? Was it one practice? Was it one game? Like how soon did you realize, holy crap, like I'm playing with this really, 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 really special player?
Well, like actually when you said I was here in training camp, it was the 99 season. I believe it was the 99 season, 98. It was right after the lockout. It was that 50 game season. And I was released on the last day of training camp. And I had a great training camp. And out of all the people on the team, he came to me. He was like, keep your head up. Like, you're going to make it in this league. You belong in this league. I wish we could have kept you, but, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, keep your head up. So, to me, that followed me. I didn't know I was going to have a chance to play with him again. But to me, that really is when I really respected him as a person, because as the number one guy on the team, he didn't have to come and, you know, tell a person who was just being cut, you know, to keep their head up that you belong in this league. But then when I came back in 02, in 03, I mean, training camp, the first day of training camp was just like, this dude is serious. And it wasn't just because how great he is as a basketball player. It was the fact that he worked harder than everybody out there. And he was the star player. You know, that's like, you rarely see that when a guy who doesn't have to work as hard is showing the rest of the team that, look, I'm going to work hard, so you better get out there and work hard as well.
I mean, was the beauty of KG, Troy, that he was the ultimate two-way player? Like, if Flip needed him to guard Tony Parker, he could have guarded Tony Parker. If he had to guard Tim Duncan, which he did a lot, he'd guard Duncan. Heck, if you're playing Sacramento, Peja, like, he could guard, like, legitimately guard 1 through 5.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he was that first, you know, two-way player that could do that effectively, you know. And he probably could have done for – if we'd have told him to guard Tony Parker for an entire game, like he could have done it, and he could have done it effectively. I think there were a lot of players back then who had that type of athleticism. But to me, once again, going back to his will, his determination and his willingness to do whatever it takes for the team to win. Like you said, 1 through 5, whether it was a possession, two possessions, or the entire game, he was willing to do it. And that's what allowed him to exceed at that.
How special do you think this weekend is for him?
I think it's very special because for him, I don't know if he ever really just sat back and realized that he was a superstar. You know, while he was playing, like I tell the stories all the time, He never took a day off from practice. He practiced 100%. The same intensity that you saw him play with in the game was the same way he practiced. So when a guy is always engulfed into his craft like that, I don't know if they ever really appreciate it and understand who they really are, because they continue to challenge themselves. Like Kobe even said before he passed, it was finally time for him to really appreciate what he had accomplished. And I think this weekend is one of those things where he's going to realize, like, I'm Kevin Garnett. I'm really KG. Like, I'm pretty sure he knows who he is, but I don't know if he's ever really just sat back and realized his impact on the game.
You were brilliant, 03-04, that playoff run, specifically that series against the Lakers. But is there any part of you that just wonders if Sam Cassell doesn't get hurt? I mean, do you guys beat the Lakers, then beat the Pistons? Like, do you think you guys would have won the championship if you had maintained your health that playoff run?
No doubt. Easily. Like, if you go back and look at that season, we handled the Lakers easily every game we played them. And we handled the Detroit Pistons, who eventually were the champs. We handled them that season because we matched up so well against Detroit. A lot of teams couldn't match up against Detroit. We had myself coming off the bench that year. But we had Sam Cassell, who was the same size as Chauncey Billups. Then we had KG, who can match Rasheed on both ends. We had Latrell Sprewell, him and Rip Hamilton. I mean, like, we had the pieces. And when we played them during the course of the year, like, we handled them. So I believe, you know, if everyone was completely healthy, of course the Timberwolves would have had their first championship.
Do you think if you guys then win that title, that KG's career path ends up differently, that the trade to Boston doesn't eventually happen, that maybe he ends up playing his entire career here in Minnesota?
I could definitely see that. Because after that year, you know, we had a couple situations with contracts and things of that nature, that next year the team was kind of disgruntled. And we actually didn't even make the playoffs that year. So, of course, winning that year, it would at least span to his career here a few more years before getting traded, if getting traded at all. I definitely think we'd have made a couple runs, you know, at the title. If no one would have got hurt that year, we'd have won the title that year. And that next year, I think we'd have been the favorites as well, because it's not like anybody gained 30 years of age in 12 months, right? So I think that next year, we would have definitely been competing for another title.
So what exactly, expound on that, Troy. Like, what exactly, you were here. What the heck happened after that run, the 04 run, the Western Conference Finals run? How do you explain what took place then, 04-05, 05-06, 06-07?
I think, you know, we had a plan. I mean, we had, I think the organization had a 2 to 3 year plan. And that plan was to win right away. And, you know, when we didn't win that title, we had, you know, Sam was a little older, but still very, very effective. Latrell Sprewell was a little older, but still very, very effective. And I think the organization made more of a business decision on who they wanted to pay coming up, because I think they only had a 2 to 3 year plan or window to say, okay, we're going to run with these older guys for 2 to 3 years, but we don't want to pay them this astronomical amount of money. But then when we didn't win that first year and bodies start to wear down, I think if we'd have won that first year, they probably would have got paid the amount of money that they wanted to get paid. And I think everybody would have been fine. But I think it was just mostly a business decision that's neither here nor there. You know, you can't really say what the organization should have done. We would have liked to have seen everybody happy and we go for another title run. But when someone's running a business, they have to look at this and that. So I think that was the major issue.
So KG puts Minnesota basketball on the map, right? Like, I don't think there's any debating that. Greatest player in franchise history. Heck, I don't even know who's number two. Maybe Cat's number two. But, like, it's a far drop off 1 to 2. But would you agree that on a national level – that he's more well-known for his time with the Celtics, even though it was relatively short-lived. But with that championship, with that legendary franchise, that on a national level, more people think of KG as a Boston Celtic, not a Minnesota Timberwolf?
Yeah, and I think that's true. Outside of, you know, that 0-2-3 season where we went to the conference finals, you know, games really wasn't, you know, televised as much as, you know, when he was with the Celtics. I think you have his fans that are diehard Kevin Garnett fans. I think they recognize and realize and appreciate his time with Minnesota. But, of course, they're going to know that his time with Boston is where he actually won the championship. But I think as far as the world is concerned, I mean, when you go to a franchise like the Celtics and then you play alongside Paul Pierce, Rondo, and Ray Allen, that just puts a little bit more fire on top of, you know, where he was playing at that time. So I think, you know, with it being the Boston Celtics, of course, I think people are going to remember him as a Celtic, but not your true basketball fans. I think they will respect and honor and remember his time as a Timberwolf as well.
What's your relationship like to this day with KG? Do you guys talk often, text often? Do you see each other from time to time?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, we text often. We see each other whenever he comes to town, but he dips in and out. He has one of those mysterious schedules. So, and then when he gets to town, me, him, and Gary Trent Jr., I mean, Senior, we'll hook up. Last time we went out to the George Floyd Memorial, walked around. It was his first time being out there. Me and G Trent, we took our kids out there. We were able to walk around with him, just take in everything that happened there. So, yeah, of course, like his business manager contacted me the other day. Was like, I'm going out there with KG. We're going to fly to Boston. So, yeah, our relationship is always intact. Whenever I need him or he needs me, we're right there for each other.
Do you think at some point 21 will hang in the rafters at Target Center? Maybe it's when, if it's Alex Rodriguez and Mark Lowry or whomever Glenn Taylor eventually sells to, maybe it's after Glenn Taylor is no longer the majority owner. But like Troy, like to me, it's mind-boggling that 21 doesn't already hang in the rafters. Like it's something, it's a no-brainer, right? Like it needs to happen.
Oh, definitely. I think it's going to happen. It's long overdue. I also think a statue needs to be out front as well. I mean, when you think of Timberwolves, you think of Kevin Garnett. You think of Target Center, Kevin Garnett. So he definitely needs that statue out front and is long overdue for that jersey in the banners, but I think it'll happen soon.
What would surprise us about KG? Now, I covered you guys back then, so I mean, I feel like I know a decent amount, but the people that will watch or listen to this, what will surprise them about Kevin Garnett?
What will surprise them is his humbleness. You know, when you watch him play and he's out there talking trash, you know, some people may be like, this dude is arrogant, or you know, but that's his job. I'll give you one story. One time when I first got here in 02, after practice, we walked in the because he always gets extra shots up after practice, so he's always down in the weight room. So he may come up 45 minutes, an hour after practice because he's still working. So we both walk upstairs, and the locker room just has socks, ice bags, just all around the locker room, right? So if we have people that come in and clean that stuff up, right? But he's the type of guy like this. He respects everyone in the building, right? So he said, man, he just went crazy on everybody in the locker room, and he started cleaning the locker room up himself because he was like, yeah, I know we got people that work and do this, but you just don't throw stuff around and expect people to pick up your stuff. Keep this place clean, right? So that's the type of person he is. Like, if he sees somebody, I don't care if they're a janitor, a lady with a baby, it doesn't matter. He doesn't have to know you. If he feel like something is going on in your life because you have a sad look on your face or something like that, he's going to stop and make sure you're all right. And sometimes financially, he'll take care of the situation. Sometimes financially, he'll take care of the situation or whatever it is. He's just a person that really cares for people. And he cares for people before himself.
I'll leave you with this. Last question. Flip's passing, even all these years later, How do you think Flip's passing has impacted KG?
Tremendously. I mean, Flip was the person who gave KG his first shot. You know, once he took over the helm as head coach, the next game, he inserted him right into the starting lineup. So when you become a Hall of Famer, you realize the person who gave you that shot to this accomplishment. So I think he's probably in his mind, and no doubt he's on his mind every single day. And I'm pretty sure we'll hear something about that during his speech. You know, I think that he was like a father figure to KG, always respected KG, always went to KG whenever he wanted to make a decision concerning the team. He always went and looked to KG and said, what are your opinions? And he didn't just ask to hear it. A lot of times, as KG said, is this, is that, he took it and he used it. So I think he have a lot of respect for Flip. And I think he cherishes every moment that he had with him. And I think he's gonna pretty much say that, you know, his career is successful because Flip gave him an opportunity.
Kevin McHale too, right? So, I mean, it was the combination of McHale and Flip. I mean, they put their butts on the line to some extent, right, Troy? Taking KG fifth overall. Now, he was highly touted entering that 1995 draft, but still, right? Like, that was a pretty darn good draft. When you're picking that high, like, you had to go out on a limb to some extent to draft a high schooler, and McHale and Flip did that, and McHale was the final decision maker.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that shows you the brilliance in the basketball mind of Kevin McHale, because at that time, no one was really – well, he was the first high school player to go out of high school in many years. And then even not on that note, no one was really at that time drafting on potential. Like, now you see it all day long. People are like, this kid is going to be good 5 years down the line. We'll take a shot on him because, you know, we don't have to spend so much amount of money. If he's a bust, then it's over, right? No one was doing that in 95. No one was drafting off potential. And I think Kevin McHale, like you said, he took a shot in the dark. It was a big risk, even though KG was 7'1", athletic. He was coming out of high school. People thought he wasn't strong enough. So for him to take that chance was like that was incredible and risky, you know, especially in a small market.
What's keeping you busy right now?
Well, I'm coaching my son's AAU team. He's in third grade. So I'm doing a lot of youth basketball coaching, training. When I had to come back here at 11:15, I was coming from a training session, training a girl basketball player. So just staying out here in youth athletics and, you know, keeping busy and trying to pass on the things that I've learned.
And is music still a big part of your life?
Yes. Right now. So I now do gospel rap. So I have a gospel rap label, have a couple artists on it. So now it's more about just sending out positive vibes and positive messages for our youth, over just, you know, the other side, just giving them an alternative to listen to steer them in the right direction.
Troy, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for doing this. Let's certainly stay in touch. Okay.
All right. No problem. Thank you.
Former Wolves point guard Troy Hudson. Let's keep the basketball theme going. The Lynx open their season tonight at home against Phoenix. I caught up yesterday with Lynx center Sylvia Fowles. Sylvia, always appreciate your time. Take me back to your first opening night. So I guess that would have been, what, 2008, a long time ago. How do the jitters of preparing mentally, physically, everything that entails getting ready for your 2021 opener, right, how do those compare to your 2008 opener?
It really does not compare. I still get jitters before every game, and I guess that's a good thing that says that my heart is still in it and I'm still willing to go out and compete every night. But I've been on edge for a while, and a lot of that has to do with me not playing much last season. And so for us to be kicking off this new season back in Target, back in some of our friends, this is going to be it. And I'm ready and I'm looking forward to it.
When you think about the way last year ended for you with the injury situation,
yes,
how much does that motivate you heading into this year?
It's all complete motivation, 100%. But the thing is, you have to take in consideration, you are getting older, you have to take care of your body more. And so I did a couple of things a little different heading into this season, and eventually it'll pay off, but so far so good.
Well, expound on that specifically. What did you do differently?
So I ate different. My off-season workouts was different. I've dropped 10 plus pounds. And so trying to take as much pressure off the lower part of my body, because I do carry so much weight into my legs. And so just trying to find little things that give me that extra edge just to stay healthy throughout the season, the route I took.
You're 35 years old now. You'll be 36 later this calendar year.
Yes.
How much more basketball do you have in you?
I'm just trying to go as long as possible. I don't want to put a date on it or a time frame on it. I just want to play as long as I can. And then whenever that day comes, then that's when I get to call it quits. But for now, I'm not putting no time on it.
I think about your MVP year, 2017.
Yes.
Do you feel like you have a lot of that basketball from 2017 still in you?
For sure. And that's about just being around the right people, making sure we be consistent as a team, and also just being healthy throughout the year plays a big part in that as well. But yes, I feel like I still have a lot of basketball to go.
You guys should learn a lot about yourselves here pretty quick, even though you still don't have your full roster. But
right.
Like Phoenix in the opener, you guys have Seattle twice on the schedule here.
Right.
Pretty quick. So I'm thinking, to some extent, you guys should learn a lot about yourselves here these first couple of weeks.
That's the beauty of what we do. You kind of just get thrown into the fire. Phoenix is a well-oiled machine, as well as Seattle. We have to see them twice in the up-and-coming week as well. But it's all about sticking together. It's going to be trials and tribulations, and things are not going to look good at first. But at the end of the day, things we can control is treating each other right and having fun. And that's what we're focusing on right now.
Expound on just the excitement level that you're not in that bubble anymore, that come tomorrow night, like a legit vibe inside Target Center.
Right. The bubble was great and all while it lasted, but it's nothing like being home in front of your fans. And I'm just happy that we are heading towards the right direction and a little bit of normalcy. And to be able to travel to other cities is also a big thing. So I'm looking forward to that as well.
Finish this thought, this sentence. For this year to be a success, blank needs to happen.
For this year to be a success, we all need to be on the same page to happen, for it to happen.
I mean, yes. How soon can that happen, though? Like,
so far, so good. I mean, I don't like to pat ourselves on the shoulder, but I think we do a really great job here in Minnesota, making sure we get the right people that fit in. It's just not about how athletic you are and how good you are as a ball player. It's how good you are as a person. And I really appreciate that Cheryl would take that into consideration. So we've been doing really good, and people always want to know the secret sauce. The secret sauce is making sure you like your teammates. And so I think we'll be okay.
Is the thing with McBride specifically that you change teams so often overseas that you're used to acclimating pretty quickly, that once
right.
she gets here, and maybe do you even know when officially she'll be here, but when she gets here that things can gel pretty quickly with her?
K-Mac will be fine. I don't think I've had a chance to play with her, probably a little bit through like USA Basketball, but she'll be fine. She's a person who gets in the gym, she work hard. She wanted to be great. And with players like that, you just pretty much fit in with everybody else when you put yourself in that atmosphere. And so K-Mac will be fine. I'm not worried at all. I think the hardest part would be for her is switching transitions, time zones, not running your overseas plays, learning new plays. But for the most part, I think she'd be acclimated very well.
So training camp, the one preseason game, I mean, you feel like you guys are ready to rock and roll?
The
expectations can be high this year?
Expectations always high, especially for us, because you just embedded into this world war machine system within Minnesota. And so the expectations are always high. Either you want to be good or you want to be average. And I don't think Cheryl strives for average at all.
On the well-oiled machine, how much of the well-oiled machine has been tweaked over the last couple of years? And is there more of an emphasis on that three-point shot, and what does that do for you?
I think that's always been our main focus, to have an in-out game. We kind of got away from it a little bit by not having shooters that can stretch it beyond the arc. But we do have new pieces that can actually do that this year, and so that's what I'm very excited about, because it's almost like pick-your-poison type thing. And so it's just fun when guards can knock down shots. It makes my job just that much easier.
We give you a lot of love. We give Collier a lot of love.
Yes.
Kelly McBride, the other new additions. Is there an under-the-radar player, Crystal, too, obviously, but is there an under-the-radar player that you feel like deserves a bit more love?
I think Rachel. She's that bit of that surprise. I think she got off in the bubble a little bit, as well as Bridget. They went off a little bit, but for people who don't quite understand, like with players like that, they pretty much carry the team. Yeah, we get a lot of that limelight, but we all know from the inside out, they are the ones who keeps us going. And without them, we're not as successful. So Rachel and BC definitely will be those players that needs to get more love, because they do a lot of the dirty work that we don't get credit for.
Do you think some of the national talking heads, some of the national pundits are sleeping on you guys?
I try not to pay attention to that, honestly. I really don't read the tabloids and the media about what they think about our team. I think since I've been here, when I was in Chicago, I don't think Minnesota ever got the credit, and they always been the underdogs, but they always managed to find the way. And so that's just how I look at it now. I really don't pay attention to what people have to say, because they're not in practice every day. They don't see what we go through every day. And so it's pretty much like, okay, you can say what you want, but at the end of the day, you can't take away heart and hard work.
How driven does Cheryl feel right now that she does want to get this thing back to that championship level that she's so accustomed to?
Man,
legitimately for championships, winning championships.
I know.
Like, how driven is she right now?
Very much driven. Today at practice, even before practice, we got started and she started going over, you know, a couple of things. What she read in the media, because, you know, Cheryl loves that kind of stuff. She gives any little edge you can give her to get her hype. She's willing to get hype. But she just was going over a couple of things about what people had to say about the team and this and this and this and that. And then, so she's very driven to get out there and prove points, which I don't think she has to try hard to do, because her team is successful every year. But she definitely got some things to say, and I won't be surprised if you catch her in the media a couple of times saying some crazy stuff.
Did the message, did it resonate with you when she was saying it this morning? Did it hit you?
I mean, it's almost like with the question I just answered about how people underrate us and they don't think we'll be good and all this and this and that. But at the end of the day, like I said, nobody thought we'd be good last year either, due to a bubble season or not. We still made it to the playoffs. And so that's something that you can't take away.
How much do you still keep in touch with Maya?
I haven't talked to Maya in a while, but for the most part, it's like we never miss a beat when we do talk. I try to give her space, and when she reach out, I reach out. So I'm not too involved.
How commendable is it, though, just everything that she's accomplished?
I'm so proud of Maya. A lot of people don't quite understand, because that's all they can think about is just the basketball portion of her life. But at the end of the day, you have to go after things which you believe wholeheartedly. And what Maya's doing beyond basketball is unreal. And the things that she has to accomplish and the platforms that she's setting for us to for us outside of basketball, I think also says a statement about Maya and who she is as a person.
Are you excited for Alex Rodriguez and Mark Laurie to take over as owners? Now, we don't know the specific.
Right.
Blaine's still going to be involved, but
right.
They're going to be majority owners at some point here in the coming years.
Right. Yeah, I'm excited about everything that's coming our way. I'm always open to change. I'm always open to meeting new people. So hopefully they as good as us to, as Glenn was to us, and I'm looking forward to it, yes.
You know what, though, on that, I mean, on how good Glenn is to you,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he is the perfect WNBA owner, is he not?
Yes.
So that anything you need, like, he's right there for you. And Becky, his wife, has a lot to do with that,
yes,
too.
I'm from to just say them both. But, yeah, for an owner to see us as equal as men and not just talk about it but also be about it, for sure sets him on the high bar of making sure we're treated right. We had the same thing as a man, but definitely you want that in an owner. And he believed in us and he gave us everything that we asked for. So you can't ask for anything better than that.
Do you think the pay scale will change at some point? Maybe it's a few years down the road.
Right.
At some point. And I'm not saying maybe it doesn't need to be quite equal with the men, but
right.
I think a lot of us would argue. So many of you players in the WNBA are just, you're underpaid.
Yes. Yes, I think there will be a money change in the upcoming years. But a lot of people fail to realize we're not asking for millions. We're just asking for what we're worth. We know we don't play as many games as men. We don't bring the crowds and all these things. But at the end of the day, we do accumulate more money than we're getting paid. And that's all we ask for, is that you give us that pay.
I'll leave you with this. Just anything you want to leave, you know, anybody that's going to watch or listen to this still, just any lasting words?
Make sure you guys tune in. WNBA dropout documentary tonight. It's going to be fun to give y'all a update of the things that went on in the bubble. And enjoy the season, because we're back, and make sure y'all support.
How just crazy was the bubble? Like, now in hindsight, like, if I said you had to go back down there, you have to head back down to Bradenton, you're going back to IMG Academy. Would you like give me the middle finger and say, screw you, I'm not going?
I might give you a side eye and say, I'm going into retirement. It just was not a place for a veteran at this age in your career. The bubble was not it. I mean, and I'm sure a lot of people can attest to that as well, but the bubble was not fun.
I get it. All. Trust me. No. I mean, that's why I led into my question by guessing you might give me the middle finger. I mean,
right. So, yeah.
I'm telling you, I even from way afar, I completely understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it was not fun at all.
Syl, thank you. All the best this weekend. And then,
you.
Even with the upcoming schedule, you know, it's challenging here early, but kick some butt, okay?
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate Sylvia's honesty. So earlier in the podcast, I had Gary Trent Sr. on. My entire conversation with Gary is available on the sports page, KSTP.com. So KSTP.com/sports. So here on the podcast, I put about 15 to 20 minutes of that Gary conversation on. I went like 38 to 40 minutes with Gary. So if you want the entire Gary Trent Sr. conversation, it's available. KSTP.com/sports. Same deal here. Brian Lawton, NHL Network analyst, Twin Cities resident, good guy, former GM of the Tampa Bay Lightning, longtime NHL player. I caught up with him this morning, wanted to pick his brain on Wild Golden Knights. It begins Sunday, 2 o'clock in Las Vegas. Brian and I went back and forth for about 30 minutes, so that entire conversation is available on the KSTP.com sports page. I will replay a portion of that conversation right now on Scoop Podcast episode 350.
Brian, always appreciate your time. Just initial thoughts. It was late last night. It was just a handful of hours ago. We finally know the Wild will open up against the Vegas Golden Knights. Heck, even maybe as recently as a week or two ago, I would have told you it looked like it would be Colorado. But Colorado has the tiebreaker because of regulation wins. So Vegas and Colorado, both elite teams. But Vegas is the 2 seed. The Wild, the 3 seed. The Avs, the 1 seed. But just initial thoughts, Wild against Vegas.
Well, I think it really worked out great for the Wild. It was the matchup, I have to think, that they wanted. In a strange twist, obviously, Vegas' second-best record in the National Hockey League. They tie Colorado for points overall, and yet they still finish second behind them because of the tiebreaker in the league. So this came down to the wire. Colorado really came on like a freight train at the end in order to finish first. I certainly compliment them, but I am very happy for the Wild not to face them in the first round. They'll have to face them eventually, but I think this first round matchup is a good break for the Wild, and it's a better matchup for them.
On the flip side, do you sort of need to be careful what you wish for? That, yeah, this looks like the matchup that the Wild wanted, Wild fans wanted, but is there a part of the fan base that should say, hey, whoa, slow down a little bit? This is still going to be uber challenging?
Absolutely. I mean, make no mistake, this is the lesser of two evils for the Minnesota Wild. Neither choice was great, but the Wild did play better against Vegas. They do match up better than them. Colorado seemed to, although the Wild beat them at times, Colorado just seems to be able to turn it up another gear and almost overwhelm the Wild with their speed. So to have the opportunity for a lot of their young players that haven't faced a lot of playoff situations, this is a great way for them to start. By no means are the Wild the favorite. Don't get me wrong. They had an incredible season. And even though they beat Vegas technically in the season series and have really dominated Vegas since they came into the league, when you look at all the underlying metrics, almost every single category favors Vegas, except for one that the Wild win. And that is their play in front of both nets. And that, to me, is where they're going to have to try to really exploit if they want to beat Vegas in this first round.
So that's why you feel like, I mean, that's one area when you say the Wild match up well with Vegas in particular. I mean, that's one area. What are some other areas?
Well, yeah, definitely better than Colorado. But believe me, of all the playoff teams, if you could pick anybody else other than Colorado, Vegas wouldn't be your first pick to want to play. As a matter of fact, they'd be your last. So from that perspective, it's going to be a challenge. But from the perspective of can the Wild beat Vegas? Well, yeah, we saw that in the regular season. They are definitely a changed team. Kirill Kaprizov, what can you say about this guy? What hasn't he done as a rookie? Is he going to be able to do it in this first round? I think so. I don't think he's your traditional rookie. I really don't. He looks so comfortable, you know, right out of the box. That's not usual in itself. He's obviously 23. That's a benefit. He's played in big games over in Russia. I think you'll see the same level of performance from him that we saw in the regular season in the playoffs, and that will be huge for the Wild in this series.
If you're the Wild, are you sort of looking at it and saying, boy, we had this great 56-game regular season run, and yet we need to open up on the road? Like, at least let us open up at home. So great at home. Give us the last change. Like, if you're the Wild, are you thinking, holy crap, how did we end up on the road?
They did have a great year. They finished ninth technically in the league. So, you know, it was the strangest of years with the pandemic. They had the type of season, though, that I agree with you. When you have the type of season the Wild had, they made huge strides this year. They made massive changes internally within their team. We saw some veteran players maybe lose a little bit of ice time. We saw some younger players step up and grab that. We saw a team really transition that's been traditionally a defensive team to more of an offensive team. We saw some great goaltending this year. Everything was awesome. It was a huge year for the Wild. It's just really unfortunate that they have to be in a division that had the first place and second place team overall in the National Hockey League.
What makes Vegas so good defensively? I saw that they gave up in the regular season the fewest amount of goals. But, like, just looking at the games they played against the Wild, I mean, just like 11 or 12 days ago, like this month, it wasn't that long ago at the X where the Wilds put a sixth spot on the board against Vegas. So, like, the Wilds were scoring against Vegas, but Brian, against everybody else, Vegas shut those teams down.
It's crazy. It's just one of those things. Peter DeBoer is a veteran coach. He's going to spend a lot of time psychologically, I think, trying to convince his team that was the regular season. This record overall, where they've been so dominant, Minnesota over Vegas since they entered the league, that was a different team. And Peter's an excellent coach, and he's a tremendous psychologist. So I think he'll have some success with moving that. But when I see these first-round series, it's really those first couple of games, those first couple of periods either, that players are kind of watching to see, is our regular season dominance going to continue in the playoffs? Is it going to be the same story? Or are we talking a completely different animal now? To me, that's going to be critical for the Wild. They have to open on time, prepared to play. If they can come out and kind of really utilize their physicality early, control play, not only in front of the nets where they do excel against Vegas, but in the corners, turn it into almost a football ground game. Just grind away at Vegas. I think they'll have a lot of success. It's a lot of success. That'll be the challenge for them, though. Can they come in and do that starting on the road against a pretty confident team with a lot of veterans? It's not going to be easy, but I tell you, I like this matchup certainly better than Colorado. In a perfect world, in the playoffs, in terms of in the West, I would have rather seen him open up against a St. Louis team that hasn't looked like itself from a couple years ago when they won a championship run. But it is what it is. This, you have to be an absolute optimist on these things. This is a positive. They didn't get Colorado in that first round.
Does it look like, I mean, if you were a betting man, I mean, a 6 or 7 game series, that this thing isn't going to end in 4 or 5 games?
If I were a betting man, I would not expect this series to end. And I would expect, you know, the series was really pretty flat. If you look at it in the season, even though the Wild won the series, both teams won 3 games out of 8. You know, it for me, it's more of a pick 'em certainly than a lot of the bettors out there are calling this series. They're just not giving the Wild a lot of respect. Quite frankly, the Wild didn't get a lot of respect to win the Stanley Cup. That's absurd to me. They had a terrific year. Dean Evason did a terrific job with this team. The goaltending was excellent. Their forwards don't get enough credit because there's so many young players and people haven't seen the history of them. Other than Kaprizov, we're not talking enough about Joel Eriksson-Ek. We're not talking enough about Jordan Greenway. We're not talking enough about just rookies like Nico Sturm that were able to come in and win their matchup. And I'm not saying he's a top six forward or anything like that, but in his role on a third or fourth line shutdown role, he's won that matchup. That's really important. If you can segregate your lines and say, you know what, we can tie them with our first line. We can beat them with our second. We can beat them with our third. We can beat them with our fourth. If we get the goaltending, we'll win the series. That's how you start to look up these matchups. And I'll tell you one thing about this season that really we've never seen in a National Hockey League, and that was the ability of teams to engineer their lineup on a nightly basis. What does that mean? It means they played the same team so often that you were able to make little tweaks with your lineup, maybe a little bit more speed, maybe a little bit more size, maybe a little bit more defensive ability, maybe a little bit more grind factor, maybe a little bit more compete down low. And I thought Dean Evason did an awesome job of that this year. They saw a lot of different flavor from their division, but at the end of the day, they saw a lot of Vegas and Colorado and St. Louis, three teams that can all play heavy. Vegas and Colorado have separated themselves because they've got great speed. This will be a challenge for the Wild, but I love their decor. I have for a long time. I love the changes that Dean Evason made. I love the changes they made in their third pair. I love the changes that the Wild made in terms of giving some of these bigger, stronger, faster, younger players opportunity. It was a fantastic year for the Minnesota Wild thus far. This will determine how people look back at it, though, how they do in this first round.
A little bit more on Dean. So you brought up DeBoer. You know, he's been around forever. Dean's been around forever, but this is his first crack as the man, right? The head coach of a Stanley Cup playoff team. So what sort of adjustment will that be for Dean?
There's no doubt it'll be an adjustment. I played with Dean on two different teams, on the Hartford Whalers and the San Jose Sharks. And the number one thing I'd say about Dino is he's as honest as the day is long. And there's been a lot of controversy in Minnesota this year about some players that aren't playing and this, that, or the other thing. Those are natural progressions for a player in his career. Dean has handled that as good as any veteran coach I've ever seen. He hasn't been malicious. I think he's actually been quite thoughtful for the players. He's been understanding because he's been around. He's been able to manage what was incredibly challenging this year. Not just that, you know, we saw some veteran players not playing as much, but just trying to keep as many players happy as these coaches were asked to do this year, particularly because of the taxi squad, was a challenge. And when I think of guys that did a really great job, it's two guys that I actually played together with on the same team. So maybe that's just a coincidence. Dave Tippett, who was in Hartford with Dean Evason and myself. These guys are more empathetic. And players are different now. They need more communication. Even though the players may not always like the message, I felt like Dino was spot on. He found a level of accountability in the Wild's room that I have to be honest, I haven't seen in a very long time. And that changed the dynamic for me. That's why, in my analysis, this team really exploded. Billy Guerin and Dean Evason made some really tough calls, calls that can be considered unpopular at times. But they were the right calls for the betterment of their group. And it seems like that would be easy to do, but it's not. Ryan Suter's minutes coming down, it was an excellent move. Suits is still awesome. He helps to formulate what I think is one of the top two or three top fours in the NHL. That's massive. Zach Parise, unfortunately, not playing maybe as much as he has in the past. That's been handled with as much grace as you can. Dino's left that up to the on-ice play to dictate and determine who goes for the betterment of the group. That's not easy to do. Zach Parise has had an incredible career. He's still able, in my opinion, to contribute in a big way, and I actually think we'll see him rise up in the playoffs and do exactly that. Not done like Thomas Steen did for the St. Louis Blues in their run to a Stanley Cup championship.
Let me stop it there. I got into more of Zach with Brian. And again, go to kstp.com/sports for that entire conversation. Brian thinks, not game one. I don't think any of us expect to see Zach Parise on the ice on Sunday. But at some point later in the series, it's Brian's belief that we will see Zach. I will tell you this much. Make no mistake, Zach is not happy. Now, he is being a professional. He's not going to throw a big stink. I think eventually he is going to seek a buyout, that Zach would like to be somewhere else next year. I think Bill Guerin would love that too. So the Zach Parise situation will be fascinating to follow once the Wild season is over. Brian thinks the Wild beat Vegas. I said Vegas in seven, that the Wild are good, but they're still one or two good players away from really making a run. And it comes down to matchups. And I get it, the Wild have had success against Vegas, but Vegas has so much Stanley Cup experience in their room. It's just, it's a matchup thing. Like, if they could have matched up against somebody else, yeah, the Wild could absolutely move on in the playoffs. But I just don't know if I like this particular playoff matchup. We'll see how it plays out. All right, Droogie's got baseball tonight, tomorrow, Monday, practice, I think Tuesday, or maybe it's Thursday. Game Wednesday, game Friday, game Saturday, game Sunday. Busy stretch of baseball. I love being hands-on with Droogie and his baseball shenanigans, baseball antics. He loves baseball, so I love to be there for every step of the way. So we are done right now, so I can get to the batting cage tonight. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. This has been Scoop Podcast Episode 350. Stay safe, stay sane.